Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. For a single deal to go through, the price has to be right for everybody involved. Simple, right? As a matter of fact, it may be way too simple for some transactions. Successful markets also require the parties trading have sufficient options, the ability to find what they want and strike a bargain with relative ease and efficiency, and a reasonable amount of confidence that they are not likely to get burned in the transaction. Plus, both sides have to want each other. In short, they have to be well matched. As my guest will tell us, matching markets are everywhere once you know how to look for them. And while it's possible for them to evolve on their own into something useful, they can also be engineered by economists looking to create rules that protect all parties without hindering free exchange. Alvin E. Roth is McCaw Professor of Economics at Stanford University and a 2012 winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. His new book is called Who Gets What and Why? The New Economics of Matchmaking and Market Design. Al, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So tell us, what do economists have in common with engineers?
Well, markets are ancient human artifacts. People have been building markets since before the invention of agriculture. So economists are now getting ready to help with that.
All right, so let's start by defining a matching economy. This is about the deals we make that require both sides to agree. So anybody with money can walk into a supermarket and buy a carton of eggs, but to get a job behind the register selling those eggs, both the candidate and the store have to want each other.
That's right, and the store might not set the wage so low that just enough people walk in to fill the cash registers. They might like the wage to be higher than that so that they have lots of job applicants and they can choose the ones they want. And so matching markets, and labor markets are matching markets are markets in which you can't just choose what you want. You also have to be chosen. You can't just go to work in a store. You have to be hired. And the store can't decide who it will hire. It has to make offers and wait till they're accepted. They have to compete with other stores. So matching markets are a little bit like courtship and marriage. You can't just choose your spouse. You also have to be chosen.
So it sounds like matching markets are inherently more complicated than those that simply operate on a money for commodity basis.
They are a little more complicated to operate. It turns out even commodity markets need some design. Think about wheat. God made wheat, but the Chicago Board of Trade made number two hard red winter wheat. So once you have a commodity, once you're at the Chicago Board of Trade, price is all that matters. You don't care who you're dealing with because you know exactly what you'll be getting. But in a labor market, of course, you can't make an offer to the whole market and say, I want a cashier. You have to interview individual cashiers.
Your subtitle is The New Economics of Matchmaking and Market Design. Does that imply that economics traditionally has focused more on commodity markets than matching ones?
I think that economics has traditionally focused on commodity markets. We focused on the function of price and how when supply equals demand, markets act as if they were decentralized. Each person can buy what he wants and the market clears, that is, the supply equals demand. But matching markets don't set prices necessarily at which supply equals demand. We've already talked about hiring a clerk in the grocery store. Think about college admissions. Colleges don't choose their freshman class by raising tuition until just enough high school graduates want to come to fill the classroom seats. It's expensive to go to college, but it's cheap enough so that a lot of people would like to go to a lot of our selective colleges. But they can't just choose to go. They have to be admitted. And, of course, Stanford, where I teach, can't just choose its students either. We have to compete with other fancy universities.
So one thing that can be important in those situations is signaling by the university, but also by the student, that if I'm admitted here, I'll actually attend.
So one of the things that can happen in a matching market where you have to make offers to individuals is that the market can become congested. While you're making offers and waiting for replies, other people who you might be interested in, if you don't get your first choices, they might become unavailable. They might match elsewhere. So that means that in matching markets, when they are congested, you have to think not just how much you like someone, but how much they like you and whether the process of courting them is likely to pay off. And that's where signals come in. People send two different kinds of signals in labor markets or college admissions markets, for example, or courtship, for that matter. One kind of signal is, look at my accomplishments, see how desirable I am, see how well I did in high school and how good a college student I would be. You should like me. That's the first kind of signal. And the second kind of signal is, I'm interested in you, so paying attention to me might pay off. If you admit me to your college, if you recruit me, I might come. If you offer me your job, I might take it, as opposed to taking a long time and then deciding not to take it, after which someone else who you might have hired may already have been hired elsewhere.
It used to be a lot more trouble than it is now to send out a lot of resumes or apply to a lot of colleges. These days, technology has made it easy. You know, a student who chooses to can send the same application to 15 schools at once.
That's right. So that's a good thing and a not-so-good thing. It's a good thing because it makes it easier to apply to colleges. And it's a not-so-good thing because it's easy to apply to colleges, the fact that you apply to a particular college is less of a strong signal of your interest than it was when you had to handwrite your essay as part of your application, and so that it was painful to apply to many colleges. So right now, if you apply to, as you say, 15 colleges, the colleges that get your application can't take that as a very strong signal that if they admitted you, you would come. They're just one of 15. And that's why it's important to send signals of your interest to the colleges that you're interested in. If one of the things I say in the book is that if you know a high school senior who's visiting college campuses, you should tell him to sign the guest book in the admissions office so that they will know that he came to visit, because a visit is a signal of interest. It's not so hard to apply to 15 colleges, but it's pretty hard to visit 15. So someone who visits is someone who, if you admitted him, might be interested enough to come.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the things that successful matching markets have in common, one of which is this thing that I think you've mentioned called thickness. For most parties to come away satisfied from entering a market like this, it helps to have numerous entities taking part simultaneously. Can you talk about some of the design modifications that can facilitate thickness in different situations?
Well, think about a dating site. A dating site to work well has to have a lot of men and a lot of women. If it had only a few men, then it wouldn't be very attractive to women. And if it had only a few women, then it wouldn't be very attractive to men. So sometimes sites like that are called two-sided platforms. They have to simultaneously build thickness, build numbers on both sides. The same thing with a marketplace like a credit card, a marketplace for transactions. Credit cards are two-sided. They have to have lots of people who want to use the credit card to buy things, and they have to have lots of merchants who are willing to take the credit card to sell things. And a credit card that failed to have thickness on both sides wouldn't be very useful. If you couldn't use your credit card in many restaurants and stores, you wouldn't want to carry it, and merchants wouldn't want to have the apparatus needed to recognize it if there weren't going to be a lot of sales made with it. So one of the first jobs of marketplaces is to make markets thick, to bring enough people together so that that they can transact with each other. And that's one of the reasons why some of the platforms we see quickly become standard. If you have a credit card, it's very likely one of the big ones, you know, a MasterCard or a Visa or an American Express. And it's hard to introduce a new credit card because it's hard to get the traction on the thickness on both sides of the market. Similarly, if you have a smartphone, the operating system is very likely to be either Apple's or Google's, Android, because a smartphone operating system is a kind of marketplace. It's a place where apps can be bought and sold. People who write apps want a thick market. They want lots of phones out there that can use their apps. And people who buy phones want a thick market. They want the phone to be very useful. They want it to have lots of applications available.
So it certainly speaks to the power of first mover advantage. If you get in there and provide a product that a lot of people want to use, you can soak up that market before there are a lot of competitors.
There are some markets that have first mover advantage, and they're the ones that make it hard to enter late. And it is the case that if there's what economists call a network externality, if the reason you like the market is that lots of other people are connected to it, then it's true that first movers can have a big advantage. And so big internet stores like eBay and Amazon, part of their advantage was that they came early and they got enough users so that it became harder for their competitors to get a thick market.
It's interesting to think about a property like Amazon, which I think they started really selling books, right? And now there's almost nothing you can't buy in a place like that.
Right. So they became a thick market for books, which was a good idea. That was a small enough market that it wasn't so forbidding to try to become a thick market for books. Incidentally, they also had to deal with congestion. Once markets become thick, they have to help people sort through all the many possible transactions that they can deal with and do it in a safe, simple, fast way. So Amazon starts off with a good search engine, and if you're just looking for books, they started off with good shipping technology. You know, they were near warehouses. They could get you the books quickly. And over time, as they've opened themselves to be a marketplace with other sellers, they've kept the market simple and uncongested. When you go on Amazon, you might buy half a dozen things, possibly each from a different seller, but they may all be shipped to you by Amazon, and you can certainly pay for them all with one click. You know, Amazon knows your credit card, and so it feels like you're buying from one seller when in fact you may be buying from many. So Amazon has overcome, with its market design, has overcome the problem of congestion of having to use your credit card six times if you're buying six different things, for instance.
That centralized platform to connect potential buyers and sellers has also been helpful to a relative newcomer, Airbnb.
Airbnb is a very interesting market. And of course, the first thing they had to do was become thick. And when you look at Airbnb's history, their early competitors were other websites that served couch surfers. So they bought some of them is how they became thick. There were other websites that had a market of hosts in different cities and travelers who wanted to go to those cities. And Airbnb bought some of those. So pretty soon you could not just go to San Francisco, but you could go to lots of places through Airbnb. But now they're a giant decentralized hotel company, and their competitors are companies like Hilton Hotels Corporation. And to understand the problem that Airbnb had with congestion, I think it's helpful to think about how difficult it would be to get a room at Hilton Hotels if you were only allowed to ask about one room at a time. Suppose when you called up Hilton Hotels, you had to say, how about next Friday evening, room 527? And they'd say, I'm so sorry, room 527 is already booked. And then they'd hang up on you. And you'd call again, and you'd say, how about room 528? I'd say, too bad. But that's a little bit Airbnb's problem, because many, many of its hosts have just one property that they're renting. So when you try to rent that, if they can't rent it to you, then you'll have to try another one. If room 527 isn't available, you'll have to try room 528. So Airbnb made a lot of efforts to make that problem less painful. For instance, nowadays, this wasn't true at the beginning, but nowadays if you go on Airbnb and try to reserve a room, you may not get it right away, but the fact that you're trying to reserve it will make it invisible to me. So when the host finally opens his smartphone and clicks on the Airbnb app, he won't find that there are nine of us trying to reserve the room and have to say no to eight of us. There'll only be you, and he might not give you the room, but only you will be disappointed, not a whole crowd of people. So that makes it easier. And of course, the Airbnb has been very aggressive in trying to get its hosts to use their smartphone app, because in the early days of Airbnb, when people were using the internet rather than the mobile internet, it wouldn't be unusual for hosts to put the room up for rent in the morning and only come home in the evening and see who had wanted to get it. And then they would tell you that room 527 wasn't available, and it would take you another whole day to investigate room 528.
We're speaking this hour with Nobel Prize-winning economist Alvin E. Roth. He's McCaw Professor of Economics at Stanford and author of the new book, Who Gets What and Why? We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Alvin E. Roth. He's McCall Professor of Economics at Stanford and a 2012 winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. His new book is called Who Gets What and Why? The New Economics of Matchmaking and Market Design. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Al, so programs, entities like Airbnb, like Amazon, and things of that ilk certainly make things convenient for traders on both sides by amalgamating the offers of a lot of different people, bringing in a lot of different potential customers to one seemingly integrated platform or integrated platform that gives a consistent experience. On the other hand, there's this question of anonymity, and we don't quite know who we're dealing with. And in order to want to trade with these companies, through these companies, we need to be assured that both parties are on the up and up.
Right. So different internet marketplaces have found different ways of handling that. And it helps to think a little bit back before the internet to how you figured out whether companies were on the up and up. If you wanted to buy a dining room table from a furniture company, the fact that it had a store on Main Street in your town and had been there for a long time gave you some ability to check up on their reputation. If they had a really terrible reputation, they probably wouldn't be there because customers wouldn't come back to them. But the fact that they're there means you can probably find someone who has bought furniture there themselves. Your neighbors may have. And so you can tell that they're a reliable company. But when a company like eBay opened up at the, you know, the dawn of the internet, you had no way to tell you weren't dealing with someone sitting in an internet cafe on the other side of the world who just claimed he could sell you a dining room table. So you needed some way to reproduce that reputation that bricks and mortar stores earn by serving customers in the same place for a long time. And eBay spent a lot of time working on its reputation system. That is, each time a transaction was completed, the parties had an opportunity to rate each other. And so after a little while, you could see that you were dealing with someone who had dealt responsibly with other people in the past. And you knew also that if he didn't deal responsibly with you, that you could harm his reputation by giving him unfavorable feedback. And over time, eBay has spent a lot of time thinking about how to refine its reputation system to make it work better. But there are other ways that internet markets can, or markets with anonymous people can help you trust them more. Credit cards are a good example of that. I'm old enough to remember when restaurants wouldn't take checks and you had to pay in cash because they weren't credit cards. There used to be signs over the cash register that said, "In God we trust, all others pay cash." But one of the things that a credit card does is it guarantees the merchant that he'll get paid. If your credit card goes through, when they check whether your credit card company thinks you're good for the debt, if your credit card company says yes, then the merchant gets paid whether or not you pay. Now it's between you and the credit card company. So that made it easier to go out to eat in restaurants in towns where you didn't live because the proprietor didn't have to worry that if you didn't pay cash, your check would bounce. So that's a third-party guarantee. Amazon does a lot of that. If you buy something from someone on their platform, I think they'll stand behind it. If they may even ship it itself. They may execute the transaction themselves. So that's another way of getting confidence.
And paying a little cost in order to have that confidence is something that most people are willing to do.
That's right. Although how the payment gets made and who pays is actually a very interesting question. So with credit cards, there are credit cards where both parties pay. You pay to have the credit card and the merchant pays a fee when you make the transaction. But there are also credit cards where only the merchant pays and in fact, you may get a little bit of a kickback on your purchases. They'll give you a refund, and, you know, a percent of the purchases you make. And that is an interesting kind of competition. It's a competition by middlemen. It means that credit cards can compete with each other by offering you more cash back. And that is very tempting. So it's hard not to sign up for credit cards that have that property. But of course, it mutes the price competition that merchants might feel compelled to engage in because now they're paying these high credit card fees. And if you line up with your credit card at the cash register in some store, and I'm ahead of you and I don't have a credit card, I'm paying cash, then because we're probably both paying higher prices than we would if the merchant didn't have to pay the credit card fees, the cash customer, I'm subsidizing your purchase because that's where that money comes from. So competition can have unusual aspects.
So let's talk about some of the challenges that you have taken on in your career. For one thing, you worked to redesign the National Resident Matching Program, which is like this clearinghouse through which most newly graduated doctors get their first jobs. How did the system work before you took a look at it and started to play with the rules? And what did you take into consideration in redesigning it?
Well, the first thing that my colleagues and I had to think about was how it had come into existence, why there was a centralized clearinghouse for doctors and not a different kind of market. And the market for doctors is a little unusual because you can only become a doctor in the United States after 4 years of medical school, and then you have to do a residency before you can be licensed to practice. So both sides of the market are locked in. You can tell in advance exactly who will be looking for residencies. It will be the people in medical schools. And you can tell exactly who will employ them. It will be accredited residency programs. So you know just who you're looking for. It's not like trying to hire college graduates in your firm. You can't tell which graduates might work for firms like yours, and they don't know what kind of firms they might work for. Medical students know just where they're going. They're going into residencies as their first job. And so one of the ways that hospitals started to compete for good residents was to try to hire them earlier and earlier in their medical school career. And it got to the point in the 1940s that young doctors, medical students, were taking their first jobs, were signing contracts for their first jobs 2 years before they would graduate from medical school and actually take that job. And 2 years in advance causes all sorts of inefficiencies in the market. It's hard for the hospitals to tell who the good medical students will be 2 years before they graduate. And it's hard for the medical student to know what kind of medicine they want to do before they've had half of their medical school training. They might think they want to be surgeons when they've done well in anatomy class and then discover that they faint at the sight of blood when they actually get to participate in surgeries. But they're already locked into, you know, 2 years in advance into a surgery residency. So that didn't work very well. And the medical community tried various ways to fix it, some of which got involved in lots of congestion so that people were getting exploding offers so that they had to accept or decline an offer before knowing what other offers would come. But eventually they decided, this is in the 1950s, eventually they invented a kind of centralized clearinghouse that in its basic form is still used today. And the way doctors get their first jobs in the United States is they go on interviews. And then instead of getting a job offer and having to say yes or no in a hurry, they submit a rank order list. They already have all the information about the jobs, the salary and the working conditions. And they submit to this clearinghouse a rank order list saying, this is my first choice, this is my second choice job, this is my third choice, this is my fourth choice. And the residency programs, the employers, do the same thing. They say of the people we interviewed, this is our first choice, this is our second choice, this is our third choice. And then something happens. An algorithm is used to create a matching of doctors to residency programs. And there's a day called Match Day, and it says you know, these days you probably learn together with your other medical school classmates where you've been matched. And the idea is you're now supposed to sign a contract with the hospital to which you've been matched and go work there. And that worked pretty well for 2 decades, at least after this clearinghouse was started. And one of the things I did to understand how marketplaces work is try to understand why it worked as well as it did. But starting around the 1970s, it started to work a little less well. And that was because in the 1950s, medical school graduates in the United States were all men. But by 1970, about 10% of medical school graduates were women. And medical students are very busy, but one of the things they have time to do is marry each other. And so there started to be couples who needed two jobs. And one of the things they noticed is that these couples didn't always go where they were matched. They would, when they went through the match, they might get matches. They might get matched to residency programs in different cities, and then they'd get on the phone and see if they could do better and find two jobs in the same city. And over the years, the medical community tried to make adjustments to help couples get two jobs in the same city, but they didn't do that wonderful a job of it. And one of the things that Elliot Perenson and I did when we redesigned the medical match is we helped deal with couples in a more orderly way, so that today today couples are asked not just where each one of them wants to work, but where they, what pair of jobs the two of them want. And so what's your first choice is a pair of jobs, and your second choice is a different pair of jobs, and your third choice is a different pair of jobs. So a couple, a two-career household, basically goes on the market as a single agent that needs two jobs and has preferences over them. But it's a little more complicated than that, because the couple may think of itself as a single agent, but the two doctors may be in entirely different specialties and interviewing an entirely different employer. So the employers continue to look at them as individuals, and the market helps this sort out so that couples can get the jobs they want, which are pairs of jobs.
What do you do with the problem of cross-cutting when I put number one on my list the facility that puts me number seven and vice versa?
Well, there's a little bit of an issue involving that. It's less of an issue than you might think, because when markets are very large, the outcomes you can get are not so different depending on how the market is organized. Basically what we have to do is in order to get people to want to go to the places they're matched, we have to make sure the matchings are stable. That is, there shouldn't be a doctor and an employer who are not matched to each other, who would both prefer to be matched to each other. Because if that were to happen, we call that a blocking pair. Supposing that some doctor gets his third choice, but it turns out his second choice, which he would prefer, also would prefer him. He only has to make two phone calls to discover that that's the case. You know, he calls up his second choice hospital and he says, I was just matched to a wonderful hospital and I'm about to sign a contract with them. But before I do, I thought I'd call you up and check whether you might have a position. And if they look at the people they were matched to and they see that they would rather be matched to him, they might answer and say, well, you know, by a funny coincidence, we do have a position. We have an extra position that we hadn't anticipated. Why don't you come work for us? And then they'd call up some poor guy and they'd say, you know, we're supposed to sign a contract with you, but you know how deans are. We had one of our positions cut, and we can't do it. So if matchings were unstable, if sometimes you could make transactions like that, then people would be on the phone all the time, and they wouldn't be, the match wouldn't work. So what you need to make a centralized clearinghouse like the medical match work is stable matchings. And it turns out when the market's large, there aren't too many stable matchings. The fact that you need a stable matching pretty much determines where you're going to go. But sometimes it matters that you are my first choice, but I'm only your second choice. And to make the process work as well as possible for the medical students, we favor the students in those cases. We have what's called a deferred acceptance algorithm with the students making proposals. And that means that if there's a stable matching where the student gets his first choice and the hospital he matched to is their second choice, and if there's another one with the reverse, then we go with the one that favors the student.
So when are, you mentioned earlier, exploding offers, which are these time-sensitive deals that may not work in the National Resident Matching Program so well, but do work in some other markets. When are they appropriate, and when do they mess everything up?
Well, sometimes they are both appropriate and mess everything up. So one reason you make, if you're a firm, one reason you make offers of very short duration is because you've learned from experience that the market is going to clear fast, and that if I make you an offer and you take a long time to decide and then say no, then the person who I would have turned to after you to make another offer, they'll already be gone. So if I'm worried that that's going to happen, then I might say to you, you have to let me know now. So that would be a sort of that would put you in a difficult situation. The market wouldn't be working well for you, because when I call you up and say you have to tell me now, what you'd really like to know is here's Al offering me an offer, but that's my fourth choice offer. It's pretty good. I could be happy with it. But I really would like to know whether one of my first three choices is about to call me up. If I were to get an hour to wait, could I talk to them and see what my prospects are? So there are markets where as the potential employer, I'm afraid that will take too long, and so I don't let you do that. But there are also markets where it's not that I'm afraid it will take too long. It's that I'm afraid you'll get a better offer, and that's why I make you decide right away. So I can have both, neutral and malign motives for saying, no, you have to decide now on the phone, because if you say no to me, then I'm going to go right down my list and make an offer to someone else. That might force you to make an offer, to accept my offer, because you feel it's too risky to wait to see if a better offer is coming.
Do those exploding offers typically favor the person who has been offered something, or favor the party that has been offered something?
So that's complicated, because it's nice to get an offer, but it's nice to be able to wait and see if you can get a better offer. So, and similarly, think of the market. So one market that right now has terrible exploding offer problem is the market for new lawyers who want to be law clerks for appellate judges. So they want to go into a very austere part of the legal market for a year or two before going to do something else. They want to assist appellate judges. Right now, if you know a law student who is about to, who has just graduated maybe this month and is about to start a clerkship, there's a good chance that means he just finished his third year of law school. There's a good chance that he was offered his clerkship early in his second year of law school, so more than a year in advance of when he's taking it. And there's a good chance that he only got one offer, that he went for an interview on the understanding that if he got an offer at the interview, he would accept it, and that he got an offer at the interview. So who is that an advantage to? It means that judges who are pretty good, too good, so good that you don't want to turn down their offers, but not so good that they can wait and let you consider other offers and you'll still come to them, that they try to have very early interviews. And that's why they're making offers 2 years in advance now. It's because that process creeps earlier and earlier. It's called unraveling of the market. And that makes the market early and it makes it thin. And both of those are bad for the market. It's bad for the market to be early because the judges can't tell who's going to be a good lawyer yet. And it's bad for the market to be thin because people don't get lots of choices. They have to decide in that instant when they get the offer to say yes or no.
We're speaking this hour with Nobel Prize-winning economist Alvin E. Roth, who is McCaw Professor of Economics at Stanford University and author of the new book, Who Gets What and Why? The New Economics of Matchmaking and Market Design. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Alvin E. Roth, who is professor of economics at Stanford University and a 2012 winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. His new book is called Who Gets What and Why? The New Economics of Matchmaking and Market Design. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Al, you also played a role in designing a new and better method of matching kidney donors to potential recipients. It's pretty straightforward if my sister needs a kidney and I'm a good match. But in many cases, patients might have multiple friends or family members who would be willing to donate, but whose organs would not work for their loved one. You saw an opportunity there.
That's right. So let me start by mentioning that it's against the law in the United States and in most of the world to buy a kidney. Right, the National Organ Transplant Act, which is American law, says that you can't buy and sell kidneys for transplant. But as you say, you might be healthy enough to give someone you love a kidney, but they can't take your kidney because the kidney just doesn't match their biology. And I might be in the same circumstance. I might have someone I love, and I'm healthy enough to give them a kidney, but they can't take my kidney. But maybe my patient can take your kidney and your patient can take my kidney, and that would be a kidney exchange. And no money would change hands, but kidneys would be exchanged, and two transplants would happen that otherwise couldn't have happened, and two lives would be saved. And that's a good thing, and that's what economics is about. It's improving human welfare through trade. So my economist colleagues and I saw an opportunity to help our surgical colleagues organize exchanges like this on a larger scale than were previously possible. And today, kidney exchange in various forms, some of them more complicated than that simple exchange between two pairs, kidney exchange has become a standard form of transplantation in the United States. So that's a good thing. But I should say at the outset that, you know, I could tell you about victory after victory, but it's in a war that we're losing. There are 100,000 people waiting in line for deceased donor kidneys, and we only do about 11,000 of those a year in the United States, and we only do about another 6,000 or 7,000 living donor kidneys. So people die while waiting for a transplant. So we need to do better than we're doing now, although kidney exchange has helped thousands of people get transplants.
Should we reconsider the laws against buying and selling? I mean, it's understandable that, you know, you can't set the price so high that only wealthy people would even have an opportunity for this. On the other hand, I think a lot of people who need a kidney transplant or have a loved one who does would indeed be willing to come up with money from a lot of different sources to make this happen.
I think that's right. But many people find it repugnant, the idea that wealthy people would be buying kidneys from poor people. So I think that the people who are advocating that we could increase the supply of kidneys by paying donors for their kidneys don't have in mind necessarily that the patients who needed the kidneys would buy them directly. You could imagine, for instance, that we could amend the National Organ Transplant Act. Instead of saying no one may buy or sell a kidney, we might say only the federal government may buy kidneys. And then they would allocate them the way we now allocate deceased donor kidneys, which we think about as a national resource. On the other hand, the people who are against that, and this is a tough, controversial debate that rages very hot and is quite active, the people who are against that worry that nevertheless, even a system that didn't simply allocate these purchased kidneys to the rich, even a system that allocated them fairly might come to harm the poorest and most vulnerable members of society, that they might be the ones who would sell their kidneys, maybe when they shouldn't. And they point to the many black markets that exist around the world. And of course, in black markets, terrible things happen. It's against the law almost everywhere in the world to buy and sell kidneys. The one exception is the Islamic Republic of Iran. But the fact that it's against the law doesn't mean that there aren't markets. It's easy to outlaw legal markets, but it's hard to stamp out illegal markets. But in a black market, you're dealing with criminals. And so indeed, in black markets, poor and vulnerable people are exploited. They are not given adequate care afterwards. Sometimes they're given hardly any care at all. You know, to donate a kidney involves a surgery. You need care for a long time after. I mean, at least potentially. It's a very safe operation, but sometimes something goes wrong, and so you need to be connected to a doctor. And in a black market, you might not be. Sometimes in black markets, people aren't paid what they've been promised. So black markets aren't a good way to think about how we would organize a legal market if we did. But there's great controversy about this. It's not at all clear that it would be feasible to amend the law against purchasing kidneys. And as a social scientist, I'm impressed by the fact that it's illegal just about everywhere in the world. So there's something about that we need to understand in order to understand better how to go forward. There is growing consensus that it shouldn't be costly for you to give someone a kidney, and presently it would be. If someone wanted to give me a kidney, they'd have to fly to California, where I live, and they'd probably need a hotel room for a few days before their nephrectomy, their kidney donation surgery, and maybe for a few days after. They might miss 2 or 3 weeks of work. So it could be really costly for someone to give me a kidney. And right now there's no convenient way to pay back those costs. But I would like to see all the various sides to this controversy get together on fixing that, because I think there's now great consensus that should be fixed. But there's not consensus at all about whether it should be legal to compensate the donor beyond his expenses. And so I've started to try to understand that. I've started to think about what I call repugnant transactions, which are transactions that some people would like to engage in and other people wouldn't like them to, even though they themselves are not directly involved. And when you start to look at it, there are lots of repugnant transactions. Turns out it's illegal to eat horse meat in California. There's a 1998 referendum that made it illegal. And of course, the reason it's against the law to eat horse meat in California is not that no one in California wants to eat horse meat. There's no law against eating cockroaches in California. The reason it's against the law in California is some people would like to eat horse meat. They come from places like France and Germany and Japan where horse meat is eaten. And there are other people in California who don't want them to do that. And enough of those people voted to make it a felony in California to sell horse meat for human consumption. But, of course, there are more consequential repugnant transactions. One of the really interesting ones that Americans have been quite divided about but is changing very quickly is same-sex marriage. Right? That's a repugnant transaction in the sense that some people want to transact. They want to marry each other, and other people don't think they should be able to. And since 2004, when it became legal in Massachusetts, it's become legal in state after state. Although other states in the United States have passed state constitutional amendments to try to prevent it. And I guess this year we're expecting the Supreme Court to make a decision that might make it legal in every state for people of the same sex to marry each other. So that's a case of repugnance changing quickly, and something that used to be widely repugnant and against the law, a transaction becoming legal. But things go the other way, too. We used to sell slaves in the United States. We don't do that anymore. And in fact, one of the common ways to buy passage across the Atlantic Ocean to come to America used to be to sell yourself into indentured servitude, so slavery for 5 years. We don't do that anymore. So it's not that as we get more modern, all our old repugnances fade away. Sometimes things that weren't so repugnant become repugnant. And what this has to do with is the fact that markets need social support, and we don't support markets and everything. And I think that economists have to understand that better. And we, everyone has to understand that better to understand how to go forward on a complicated, controversial case like how can we get more kidneys?
There's a lot of ideological debate in this country, Al, over, how much markets should be regulated by government. And there are, good arguments to be made on both sides. What can we learn, though, from the natural evolution of things like black markets, which by their nature are not regulated by any government entity because they're not supposed to exist, and yet they do?
Well, among the things that marketplaces are supposed to do is make markets safe to transact in. And one of the things about dealing with criminals is it's not safe. It's not safe because they're criminals. They might hold you up. When you come with your money to buy drugs, they might shoot you and take your money. But also, they might give you low-quality drugs, and you can't go and sue them and say, I thought I was buying high-quality crack cocaine, and look what you sold me. So they're not safe in many, many ways. That's what we're speaking about black markets for kidneys. But better policing isn't always the solution. We had a big experiment with that having to do with the sale of alcohol. We amended the Constitution. We had prohibition. And then it turned out that it was hard to get rid of illegal markets for alcohol, and they gave rise to organized crime. And we amended. We changed the Constitution once again to say, never mind. And, of course, we're having similar evolution about illegal markets for drugs like marijuana. Mm-hmm. So there are now a number of states that allow what's called medical use of marijuana. And there are two states, I guess, Colorado and I think Oregon, that now allow recreational use of marijuana. It's just a legal drug there. Neither of them has suffered a catastrophe, as near as I can tell. So I'm guessing that that's something that we're going to see evolution towards legalized markets. And legalized markets will allow regulation, control. They'll allow, regulation how you label the doses, right? I mean, we make alcohol be sold in ways that tell you what percentage of alcohol you're drinking, so you can form some judgment about how much you can safely drink. And I'm sure that will start to be true with marijuana as well, in the places where it's legal, and that will make the market safer. But in general, markets have to be safe. It's true of legal markets as well. One of the early jobs of medieval kings was to make the roads safe so that buyers and sellers could come to big markets, and that you wouldn't be waylaid on the road on your way to the market or on your way from the market and robbed of your goods or of your money. And that's what eBay is doing when it has a reputation system is it's making it safe to transact with someone who you can't see. So safety is one of the big jobs that marketplaces have to perform to make the market work well.
If you surveyed the landscape, and is there a particular market that you would like to work with designing next or work with refining the design for next? Has anything caught your attention that you're not actively working on but you would like to?
Well, so the markets that are in most need of design aren't always the ones that are the most promising to spend your time trying to redesign. Often the reason they're in need of design is there are reasons that they're not working well. So I'll answer your question in a minute. But think for a moment about Uber and how it's disrupting the market for taxis. Mm. Taxis in the U.S. were defended behind a high regulatory walls that were hard to deal with because they were city by city. I live in Palo Alto, California, and if I want a taxi, I would have to call a taxi company headquartered in Palo Alto because Palo Alto, the city of Palo Alto, licenses its own taxis. And that taxi can take me to San Francisco, but when I want to come home again, if I want a taxi, then I have to call a San Francisco taxi company because only taxis licensed in San Francisco are allowed to pick people up in San Francisco. But if I have the Uber app on my smartphone, then I can use it in both places. Now, Uber has had a lot of its success partly by disregarding those regulations, and so we'll see how that plays out. But that was a market in need of redesign that was hard to redesign because it was defended by a thicket of laws and regulations. Now, one market that works not so well in the United States is the market for healthcare generally, not just kidney transplants, but all parts of it. And of course, that's a giant part of our economy. And so there are institutions and procedures and careers already invested in doing things the way they are. And that makes it hard to change. So I would guess that the change in healthcare, the interesting changes in healthcare are most likely to come on the part of big companies that self-insure. Because the reason a big company that self-insures is different from, say, an insurance company is an insurance company mostly transacts with you when you're sick, and their rates are determined by how much things cost. So they don't have a terrible interest in keeping costs down. They're a, you know, they profit on the transaction. And they're not necessarily interested in keeping you healthy. But your company, which self-insures, it's costly for them when you're ill, and it's good for them when you're healthy. When you're healthy, you come to work. So they enjoy your good health as well as they regret, you know, your illness. And so you think about things that are hard to pay for in the current medical system, like clinics that would help diabetes patients have better nutrition and control their disease. That's a lot less expensive than amputations and transplantations, but ultimately it's a much better kind of healthcare. But we have trouble financing those in our current healthcare system.
The new book by Nobel Prize winner Alvin E. Roth is Who Gets What and Why, The New Economics of Matchmaking and Market Design. Al, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.